The tension in the room had reached a fever pitch and was about to burst. Arrow whinnied quietly to herself. It was hers. This game was hers. She was about to discard her final card in this game of modified Crazy Eights, colloquially called Really Crazy Eights. Her opponent, the Quaker Oats guy, was aghast. How could this horse possibly win Really Crazy Eights, which the Quaker Oats Corporation had rigged against her? How could this horse win the 20 million pounds of oats, pay off her debt, and free the Aerocast from a lifetime of playing Ocarina of Time in the underground torture zoo? The tension exploded as the horses and stables around the gambling table exploded in neighs of delight and disbelief, but also with a newfound sense of purpose and a renewed interest in life. The Aerocast ran to meet Arrow. She had navigated the labyrinth's gambling puzzles well within the allotted 13 hours, and in the life-or-death best-of-eight match of Really Crazy Eights, she had prevailed against all odds to save the day. "But wait," the Quaker Oats guy said, licking his lips, salivating at his own Machiavellian villainy. "Double the stakes on another game of Really Crazy Eights," he snickered, eyes flashing with menacing purpose. 40 million pounds of oats, or I turn the Aerocast into dog food. And it won't be fed to dogs. It will be fed to school children in our evil boarding school." "Don't do it, Arrow," the Aerocast pleaded. "You have enough to settle your debt, and you can never eat 40 million pounds of oats before they go bad." "But it is human nature to crave more, and it is equine nature to crave oats." Much to the horror of the Aerocast, their mighty steed agreed to the terms. So we'll leave that on the cliffhanger to begin our podcast for June 2016. We will be covering the film Labyrinth. But before we go into the labyrinth, before we attempt to solve that mysterious place, what have you been up to in this month of June?
I have to say that was a very dramatic intro. I was on the edge of my seat. I didn't know Aggro had this gambling problem. We have to do something about that. But that's what I've been up to. Well, summer is now kicked in and it's really hot and I'm not appreciating it, but it's going to get hotter and we complain about this every time. But that's the summer for you, isn't it? So for what I've been playing, about an hour before we record this podcast, I actually finally finished Fire Emblem Fates Conquest. Last night, I thought I could do it, and then I completely miscalculated the damage. So this is important tip when you play Fire Emblem. Make sure you calculate damage correctly, or things are going to be really bad and upsetting.
So you got killed in the final fight, and you redeemed yourself tonight.
Yeah, I could have proceeded forward, but I wouldn't live with myself knowing that someone died in the final battle. I just one more turn, and I could have done it, but someone died, and I was like, oh, I can't do this.
So what's the deal with permadeath?
What's the deal with permadeath? It was also kind of upsetting because I do have the staff that is the one time used to resurrect someone, but I couldn't even use that. So it was just an upsetting moment yesterday, but I came back prepared with a smarter strategy and more caution and better calculations, and I cleared it.
Are you going right into another playthrough, or?
I'm thinking about going onto Hard Classic. I felt that Normal overall was a really solid experience. It felt like what I expected Normal, standard Fire Emblem difficulty to be, but there was a part near the middle where it started to lull. It was building up gradually, and then it got a bit too simple for me. Like, I felt like I was going through chapters without much hassle, and then it started picking up near the last four endgame chapters. So I think I'm ready for hard mode. I think I'm ready for that extra kick. And then maybe one day I'll finally move on to Lunatic.
This particular Fire Emblem, does it address a lot of the complaints you had about the previous installment, or how does it rank up compared to the rest of them?
I definitely think so, because Awakening had a ton of problems, including most of the map design was really weak, lots of open fields for no reason. Pretty much almost all the objectives in Awakening were rout the enemy, and in a game where you can grind, why do you need it to be rout the enemy? I think it's more interesting as an objective, like seize or kill boss, because that means you have to prioritize, do I want all my units to get XP? Or do I find it more efficient to rush the boss instead and be more concerned about the EXP of certain members of my party? And then Awakening also had the stat inflation problem, which I think was addressed pretty well in Conquest. It also had the para problem where I felt like the other unit was pretty much not existent, so you pretty much went into Awakening with half your party, because the other unit would be paired up with one of them, and then they'd just be extra stats. In Conquest, they did have the attack stance and the guard stance, which I think I mentioned when I first started playing this, but I think that makes better use of another character, so most of the time I usually come in with a full fill up every square. Even though sometimes it probably was better to come in with a low amount of units, but I'm not good enough to play that way. And let's see, what else is there? Conquest also had definitely some more interesting map design like gimmicks. There's one where you have to break pots throughout the chapter and they all have different status effects. So that made the strategy more interesting. Some gimmicks were kind of weird, like there's one where the wind will push you up and down. I didn't really find that mostly strategy, mostly annoying, but I guess it was interesting as a concept, so I can't really hate on it. I'd rather take that than the big empty fields. And I just think enemy placement was better. It was overall a really good game, and I really like Conquest. I don't know if I'll play Birthright, which is the one that's more Awakening-esque. If I do play that one, I'll probably play on Lunatic just to get it over with, but I don't know how much fun I'll have with that anyway.
You gonna play the middle path?
Yeah, the middle path that pretty much combines the two somehow. The third path that is unlocked since you beat one of them. I definitely want to play that one just because I want the full story. Even though the story, as I've complained about many times, is really ridiculous. But I just want to enjoy that one at least.
So it's good to hear that it was an improvement in a lot of ways. Yeah, I don't know if I agree with splitting these into two or three separate purchases. But at the very least, they're giving people that can choose the kind of experience that they want to have, I guess. I still don't agree with splitting them, but at the very least, they can cater to both parties, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't really agree with splitting them either, because I'm so hardcore into Conquest. I really like this game. Awakening, I felt like, had too many mistakes, so when I see them repeat, it's just like, come on, guys, this isn't the way to go.
So, ultimately, the grooming minigames and things like that, how do they actually play into the game? Are they actually useful, or is it just there for fluff?
It's mostly there for fluff, because the grooming thing, you get one support bonus out of it, like one support point, and you could just get the DLC that was free when you bought this game, and you can support grind that way, which is a lot easier. I kind of liked it when it was with my spouse. I was totally okay with the grooming part, but at that point, I was like, I don't really want to pet anyone else. Why is this still an option? It was just really weird to me.
Well,
I got married for a reason, okay?
Yeah. What did they replace that in with in the North American radius? Take it out.
They just took out the face petting part. You still go up to someone and talk to them, and they say their line. Instead of you spending 30 minutes drawing circles on your screen and they say a couple lines to you. So they pretty much reduced the lines spoken and then just took out the stylist thing.
I guess we shouldn't focus on that because everyone's focused on that. Anything else that you need to say about farming?
If I had to recommend anything from FE14, because there's three different games, I think Conquest is definitely the way to go. I think it was really smart and I think they put a lot of dedication to this one. I don't know, I mean that's being really mean to Birthright, but I don't like the idea of big open maps and no objectives that are just route the enemy. If it's all like route the enemy, then it's just like, come on, we don't need to see Awakening again. I think that was a bump in the series. It was fun, and I'm sure Birthright is still fun, but I don't know, Conquest is really satisfying.
Fire Emblem Awakening though was pretty huge, wasn't it though, so you're going to see the aspects of that game percolate through the series going forward. I mean, for better or worse, they're not going to do more Fire Emblems now that they are. You're going to have to, I guess, deal with some of that.
Yeah, I'm coming up as cold to Birthright, and I know I shouldn't really make fun of it, even though I haven't played it yet. But Conquest is cool.
Right. Now, the middle quest, again, like you're saying, if you're going to choose one of them, like who would actually choose just to play the middle quest? Wouldn't you need some context from one of the other two to actually have the most appreciation for the combined one?
You can't even play the middle path until you beat either Birthright or Conquest anyway, so you'd have to experience one side of the story at least. It kind of works best if you experience both sides, because there's still going to be holes in the plot if you have just played two of the paths. And that's really ridiculous. So that goes back to the complaint about there being three split paths, but I don't know, I guess they really want to make three games.
I guess they did. Well, it's the Pokemon syndrome. I don't like it, but I can see the, you know, the financial reason for it. Doesn't mean I have to like it, though.
I would say Birthright is the one that's easier to approach for newcomers, but I have to say Conquest sold better. So we'll see what the future holds for Fire Emblem 15.
The Conquest sell better everywhere, though?
I think so, yeah. I think it sold better in both Japan and the West. I don't know about Europe. Like, when I say the West, I mean America. I'm pretty sure America has Conquest selling better. I think Japan, they were pretty close, but in the end, Conquest, I think, became the one that sold more units. But I don't quote me on that.
Well, there you go. In terms of what gets added into games and what gets taken out, it's money that speaks. So at the very least, some of these more classic and traditional elements that you like from Conquest, or some of these more difficult elements or less hand-holdy elements you might see going forward as well. So
moving on to Fire Emblem, I also picked up and cleared Valhalla, Cyberpunk bartending action, or waifu bartending as it goes around. It's pretty much a visual novel, and you have segments where you mix together drinks, but as a visual novel, the main pull of it is the characters and the story. And the developers are from Advanced Wiz, which currently is going through some really bad economic times right now. So I see a lot of that dystopian future presented in Valhalla as a reflection on what's going on in Venezuela right now. In a way, I find it kind of scary, and I don't know, just hearing how people try to get through their lives is also, in a way, I hope they can figure out a way to get out of there. I hope this game, you know, pulls in some cash so they can do something better about their situation right now. But, I mean, there's a really good cast of characters in Valhalla. It's called Waifu Bartending because most of the cast is female. I mean, there are some dudes there, and it's not really a dating sim, but you do, I guess, hook up with girls in it? I don't know, I only got one of the endings, and I ended up with one of the girls. I didn't exactly know how that happened, but it just sort of did.
So you end up actually with one of the patrons, huh?
Yeah. I'm not really sure how that happened at all, because I felt like I treated everyone equally. But I guess just the way the story came together, it's considered the bad ending. So because I forgot to pay my rent, I kind of spent too much buying stuff for my room and not caring about my bill. So I guess that kind of defaults that I ended up with her, because she was the only one who offered a place to stay, I guess.
Yeah, that's really what brings people together. That's what's most important, I guess.
Yeah. But in any case, yeah, I mean, it was a fun game. Some characters were kind of annoying, and some characters I thought would be really annoying, but I kind of grew to like them. Some characters I loved from the start, and then I loved them even more by the end of the game. It's just really a reflection on what's going down there, and just how people are coming together and getting on with their lives, and it gets kind of sad at times and emotional, and I really enjoyed it, and I'd probably recommend it as well.
Yeah, it sounds interesting, like a gritty reboot of Tapper or something.
A gritty reboot.
So, yeah. So, yeah, I mean,
I had played a demo of it at PAX East, so I had gotten a taste of just, like, the visual novel aspects. I mean, we got to talk to a few people and mix some drinks, and that was basically what I expected from it. I just didn't know how much the cast would be influenced by all this bad stuff happening and how much I cared, and then I didn't expect so much anime, actually, despite it being called Waifu Bartending.
It would be a surprise that they don't get any kind of funding or support from the government there, because I know there's a number of South American developers, like Torin is part of some kind of heritage program because they want to generate revenue, so it's unfortunate that they're in this kind of state. So it's surprising that that they don't have some kind of support from the government, but I guess that depends on what kind of government Venezuela has right now.
Yeah, I'm not too
It's
familiar with the
unfortunate, though.
situation. I just know it's bad. I was remember reading their dev blog, and they're mentioning something like, "Oh yeah, we can't really work as often because we get 4-hour blackouts." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, it's really, it's probably during like, you know, afternoon, not like at night where it'd probably be like whatever." But yeah, it's must be pretty rough, and I hope they get some good revenue out of this.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is if you want to get it, don't wait for the sales.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to be all political about this game. I mean, I really enjoy it on its own, even if I had not known about the Venezuela situation. I just think overall it was a really endearing game. And I'm gonna play some more, just to get some achievements, because those Chivos. But I also want to experience more of the cast, because it's a really fun cast, and I like them. That's about it for me. What have you been up to, Matt? Anything less toasty?
Yeah, no, I guess it's pretty warm here as well. Summer's starting to kick off, and I've had a pretty good 3.5 days since we last recorded. So,
Yeah, it's hard to talk about things when we recorded so shortly beforehand.
yeah, well, three days is, of course, exaggeration, but it has been not too long. As for what I've been playing, the infamous Mighty No. 9 has been released since we last recorded, and I played through that. I don't really want to focus on the campaign for it. I will say that it is, a campaign that often frustrated backers and were often like, "What? Where is this project going? Or why aren't you focusing on this project? Why are you trying to do ancillary projects?" So while the game itself is mediocre, it is crushingly disappointing because of what was promised at the outset, and then how barely any of those promises have been met. But the game itself, if you get beyond the campaign and all of the sort of bad press and evil spirits, I guess, that go with it, like if you get beyond that, it's not a terrible game. It is mediocre, though. I played it on the PS3 because I was like, I'm not going to get this on Steam because it'll probably break my computer. I don't know what the fuck's going to happen when this game comes out. So I'll just get it on PS3 because then it's a platform that is guaranteed to work, or so I thought. It suffers from humongous frame rate issues. Unfortunately, there's like two good weapons in the game: Battalion's weapon and Brandish's weapon. And Battalion's weapon, you fire a missile and you press the button again to detonate it, and this causes so much fucking slowdown. But unfortunately, it wrecks everything, and it's like one of the only good weapons in the game. And it also seems to slow down whenever the screen transitions or whenever there's a lot of things on the screen, and that often happens in these instant death areas. So all of a sudden, you're dashing through the air, and the game fucking hangs, and then you're dead. It's like, oh, for fuck's sakes. So the frame rate's a big issue. Level design is really bland. It's often just big, semi-empty rooms with basically the same enemies in every level. There's maybe one or two enemies that are unique to a level. Otherwise, they're very kind of plain enemies that don't have a whole lot of character and are repeated a lot. And the levels are generally, like I said, just very, very generic layouts, and they really like this electricity stuff that kills you instantly. Like, that's their big gimmick to every fucking level. There's a couple of levels that have a bit more flavor, but then there's one level where you have to find Mighty No. 8 in the level to engage in a fight with him. And it's a well-drawn level, but the level itself is just like one long horizontal loop with basically no variance. So it's like the environment's really good, but the level layout is so fucking banal. It does some good things, like I find that enemy weaknesses don't really matter a whole lot, but if you save one Mighty, they will help you in another stage, and that's kind of interesting. But I mean, it's just that it's very boring. Very boring levels. And I guess that's what's most disappointing. Like, I could get beyond the art style. The art style is what a lot of people focus on. And there's a lot of hyperbole about Mighty No. 9, like, oh, it's this and that and this and that. I could get beyond the art style if the game itself was inspired, but it's not. And I don't hold any grudge against the workers on it, because obviously they had to do to whatever. Like, they had to work to whatever plan that Comset provided them, and obviously they didn't have $4 million. They had to have it after tax and Kickstarter fees and all this. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I think the game was stretched too thin, being on like every platform ever, and it didn't work on a lot of platforms on release. And
I don't even think I can play it yet.
You can't play it, and Chris, I don't know how I don't know how it's going to work on your Mac. It might not work. So just prepare yourself for that. I don't know how excited you are to play it, anyways, but. But prepare yourself for disappointment if you're trying to play it and it doesn't work, because that's sort of been the case so far. I think it's just the arrogance of the campaign that really gets people's goat. And for the record, Inafune didn't say it's better than nothing. That was his, like, his translator, but still, that's a representative of concept. And when you address your launch as better than nothing, it shows no confidence in your product, regardless of who's speaking it. So how's the consumer supposed to have confidence in the product if that's the case, right? It's just, I mean, I feel like I've been very muddled in talking about this. It's just a mess in a lot of respects. I should mention some of the voice acting is really fucking bad. Some of it's good, but some of it's really, really bad.
Is anyone screechy?
Well, it's not that the character is very screechy. It's just that she repeats her attack dialogue every single fucking time she attacks, and she's attacking or speaking constantly, and that just gets under my skin. But, you know, it's not a... It has its moments, I guess it has its moments of inspired gameplay, but for the most part, it's just average. It's just average, and I think that's what's maybe most disappointing about it. You can't even really say it was such a colossal failure, other than the campaign and the promises not being met. But you also can't say this was a tremendous game, because it's not. I think it's a lesson about crowdfunding. I don't think I'm going to trust concept games going forward unless they're proven by my peers and by example that they're worth picking up. I'll never pre-purchase or fund them again. I don't know. It's been a mess, and I'm probably going to try to consolidate my thoughts better in some format. I don't want to bog down my site with negativity, but I might try to do it for this, because I still have a lot to get off my chest, and I don't want to talk about it any further on the podcast, really. So we'll see what I do. We'll see what I do. That was Mighty Number 9.
It's a mystery of what happened.
Yeah, who knows? It was almost like the art style they chose was almost immediately after the campaign. It's like, okay, this is the art style we chose. Nothing like the concept art. You don't expect it to be like the concept art, but you expect the vision that was presented to you to at least have a go at doing it. Anyways, I've spoken enough about Mighty Number 9.
And don't rule out Kickstarters because of this, because a lot of good games have come out of Kickstarters. Like, let's not forget Shovel Knight or Hyper Light Drifter or Kentucky Road Zero.
Hark Forth Alicia or Children of Morta. I mean, there's Kickstarters that I've backed that I'm really excited about. So I'm not, you know, ruined on Kickstarters, but let me just say Bloodstained had better be fucking fantastic. Or I'm done for Legacy Creators.
Well, I was all cautious when I backed Bloodstained. I didn't put too much into it after the Mighty Number 9 issue.
I think Iga's a bit more reputable than Inafune at this stage. Well, anyways, I don't want to get into the politics of it. It's just, it's a legacy project. You have to, like, anytime you back on Kickstarter, if you're backing for a game or something that you want to see happen, or a movie that you want to see happen, or whatever it is, it's a something that you're spending with your heart and not your reasoning with. And any kind of thing like that, it's based on passion, but you can't just have it purely based on passion. You have to dial it back and say, okay, these are the risks. What am I going to donate to this? Is this, you know, stupid extra skin for the game worth $700? No. I'd say back them at, like, the usual asking price of a game. If you want to see something happen, I think that's fine. You know, it's just use your head. And I think myself and a lot of people, their head got away with them, or their heart got ahead of their head when it came to Mighty Number 9. Because it was electrifying when that game was reaching its goal, that was electrifying. And maybe that's like what's so disappointing is how positive everyone was before the campaign ended, and just how, you know, everyone bottomed into the abyss going forward. It's actually incredible the change in attitude of backers of this game, the people that gave their love and support for it. It's just phenomenal the change in attitude over the last 2.5 years. Getting beyond Mighty No. 9, that's really all I've been playing because I've been watching anime cartoons for the most part. I started...
That seems to be your thing lately, just lots of anime cartoons.
Right. So, I'll get to anime cartoons in a second. I'm not going to speak a whole lot about it because I've only done a little bit so far. I picked up Doom 3 Collection, which includes Doom 1 and Doom 2 as well. I haven't played them in, like, 20 years or something, so... I'm not that great at them, but I'm playing them on Ultra Violence, which is the hard mode, and I cleared Knee Deep in the Dead today, so that's the first episode of Doom. I'll talk more about Doom in a month's time. I've never played Doom 3, so I'm kind of looking forward to playing that. It was very controversial when it was released, so I'm looking forward to playing that now. I'm enjoying it. That's all I'll say for this month. As for anime cartoons, I mentioned last month that I was watching Kaiji, and I've since finished the anime and finished the third part of the manga. So, I don't know, I forget how much I went into Kaiji last month, but essentially he's sort of a gambling addict, and the anime sort of chronicles his high-stake gambles to resolve a debt, and this debt was one of his friend's debt that he co-signed on. So while he's sort of down on his luck and sort of going in circles like a lot of people do, the debt wasn't originally his, but it gets him into all these situations of like high-stake life-or-death gambles that, you know, some of them are like they're very basic games, but they have these really interesting twists on them, and how Kaiji breaks them wide open, and, you know, it's just really interesting look at, like, the human nature, and I don't know, you get kind of cross at Kaiji, because it's like, why the fuck are you doing this, man? Like, you're already ahead, but it's his nature that he only feels alive when he's gambling, or when, like, a lot is on the line, so it's a really good series. I think that Pachinko arc went on way, way, way too long.
Like, maybe it did, but I don't think so.
You don't think so? I mean, it's just that it could be condensed, I think. It could be condensed because there's like, it was getting towards the end, and I was like, how are they going to stretch 500 balls over 6 episodes? And, you know, it turns out this and that happens. You know, spoilers, but it went on too long, and the scenery didn't change enough to keep it interesting. Minor spoilers, but it's well known, the third part in the manga, it's basically takes place in one room the whole entire arc, and it's about Mahjong. For me, that was like, man, I don't know anything about Mahjong. I started to learn some as it went on. It's sort of a special two-player variant of Mahjong, 17 steps minefield Mahjong, that you can only win off your opponent's discard pile. And it's dense. It's like really dense in terms of rules and technicalities and strategy and all that. But once you get over the hump of having to learn Mahjong, or if maybe you already know it, that's a really good read as well. I just started part 4 as well. Part 4 is not finished yet, but I started that a couple of days ago, but I've been taking a few days off from Kaiji because it's honestly a pretty intense series, and I kind of need a breather from it because, yeah, it's intense.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can recommend you Akagi now, since you don't seem to be taking too well on part 3 of Kaiji, because Akagi is entirely Mahjong.
I don't know, it's not that I'm not taking on it, it's just that my appreciation for it, it is probably not as high as someone who already knew Mahjong and could appreciate this variant. because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the strategy. I enjoyed learning about it. It's just that where I didn't have background with it, it was difficult for me to get into it initially, and now I kind of want to learn like just traditional Mahjong, so maybe it had an effect in that way. Again, my biggest complaint about it is that it's all one gamble in one arc. I kind of like when it's broken up more, like the very first arc had, the Espoir and Human Derby and E Card and the final gamble with spoilers. So, like when there's four different gambles in the first arc and one gamble in the third arc, you can see where maybe some of my frustration with it comes. And basically, Kaiji wastes a lot of time with allegory and metaphors and repeating the same thing again and again and again. And that's also true for the pachinko. That's also true for the pachinko. They could really cut some of the chaff from it, but then maybe it wouldn't be so dramatic and over the top. So I like it how it is, anyways.
I didn't think I liked Pachinko either, but man, that antagonist though. Do I really like that antagonist? I just like him because he's moe and beautiful.
Well, I wouldn't say he's beautiful because he did brutally. Spoilers, he did brutally torture Kaiji, so.
Yeah, but
I
also, I mean, the
think.
fact that he's, fixing his eyelashes when you first meet him. I'm like, oh, look at this guy.
He does have an interesting backstory in terms of he's been. People belittled him his whole life, kind of thing, and a lot of the things about Kaiji's villains is that they might have had initially like all the best interests or all the best intentions, but Kaiji's about how money and power corrupt, and it's even Kaiji is corrupted. He goes on these long, long spiels about how friendship is important and how the human spirit is indomitable, but then he's got people that betray him, he's got people that delight in his pain. So he has to, take his worldview up against like the worst of the worst in terms of greed and avarice. So it's a brutal show, and it's maybe even a bit of a downer of a show, because I'm sure a lot of people that watch it, they can relate more than they want to with Kaiji's circumstances. So it's I recommend the show if you want something a bit darker, a bit more dramatic. It's not going to be the regular fluff that a lot of anime is. And in fact, I've seen a lot of the negative comments I've seen about Kaiji have been about the art style and how everyone is ugly and all that. But I mean, it's supposed to be a seedy show. So everyone, I mean, you already said Ichijo is supposed to be beautiful or whatever. That's fine, but. No, I mean, it's like not everyone in every anime or manga has to be gorgeous, and people in real life aren't. And this is the underworld, and it's brutal and it's a nasty place. Not everyone has to be gorgeous in this, and I think the art style reflects that well as well. So I don't know. I have no problems with the art style personally.
Yeah, Akagi might be interesting to you, bringing back Akagi. Because it's just wildly different than Kaiji. I mean, Kaiji, like you mentioned, has a more human element, and Kaiji is presented as the underdog, where Akagi is presented as this goddamn mastermind of Mahjong, and you read this just to watch him destroy everyone, and it's mostly about the psychological play about it.
Well, I mean, that's why you watch Fist of the North Star, is to see Kenshiro destroy everyone. So, sometimes, or One Punch Man, right? So, sometimes having a hero that's basically guaranteed to win is all right as long as it's written well. So, as long as this property is written well, it's probably pretty good. As for other anime cartoons, Sailor Moon Crystal finished its third season. Some sketchy animation towards the end where people are just like kind of standing on the background and other heads like pop in and things. Whatever it is. Fucking gross animation at some points, but it finished on a pretty good note. It finished on a pretty good note. Well, it finished on the note it was intended to finish on, but it did well the last episode, I think. I'll talk more about the pacing in Ace Attorney when it finishes. I just want to mention that the DL6 episodes were handled piss poor. They were way too fast. They gave you absolutely no time to feel the connection between Edgeworth and Phoenix. They gave you no time to feel a lot of hate or anger or righteous indignation against Von Karma. Anyways, I thought it was poor.
And I thought the way they changed stuff to make it fit in the episodes was really weird. I think the movie did a way better job at adapting this case.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just didn't feel the tension or the emotion in this because Phoenix pulled it out of his arse all within one episode, accused and proved in one episode.
Pretty it's much, just, yeah.
Like, I forget the court in the court sessions in Ace Attorney, but I remember going in and you knew that Von Karma had to be stopped and there was a lot of tension about it. It just felt like it wasn't there. That said, the fanfic episode, this puppy episode that played this past week was actually a really good episode.
Cute.
It was cute, and I'm glad that he got to keep the dog, because if Von Karma threw it out the window or something...
Oh, God, I was so worried about that.
Yeah.
What happens to the dog, though? Doesn't the dog, belong to Dick Gumshoe in the games later on?
There is a Shiba named... Missile in the games, but it wasn't in the anime.
What happened to the dog? Although we did also get a 3-year-old Francisca Von Karma out of that, so that was also pretty cute. Although she is 3 years old and has a whip already, so that's kind of concerning.
Was she 3 in there? And speaking perfectly?
Well, I think Edgeworth is about 10 when this happens, and I think she's 7 years younger than Edgeworth.
He did do the Prosecutor Edgeworth chooses death at the end of it, which sort of suggests to me that they're not going to do Damon Gant, because he wrote that note after that.
Right.
So, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see that.
I really wanted to see it, because SL9 is a really good case. That has a really good cast, and Damon Gant is someone to be afraid of.
Yeah. I mean, they change everything in the anime anyway, so...
That's true,
Maybe we'll see us.
Although the next episode is going to be straight on to the second case of Justice for All, so I guess they skipped the first one, where Phoenix gets amnesia. What was that case even, looking back on it?
Yeah, so did they skip that one?
I think so. It looks like they're skipping right to what's going on in Maya Fey's village. So we're going to get some really awkward animation in a couple episodes.
Oh, I've Pearl Faye getting...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the most dubious part of the entire games. But anyhow. That's what I've been up to this month. Labyrinth is a 1986 fantasy adventure film, a Henson Associates Lucasfilm collaborative effort based on conceptual designs by Brian Froud. Featuring dogs, babies, puppets, and the late, great David Bowie, Labyrinth presents a foreboding world populated by a colorful ensemble of characters and creatures. A beloved classic to many a child of the 80s, Labyrinth would be the last film directed by Jim Henson before his untimely death in 1990. Labyrinth, of course, it's a classic film. A lot of people call it a classic. But we're going to start at the beginning. How were you introduced to Labyrinth? Is it something from your childhood? Is it something that you got into later? It's like, oh, hey, David Bowie looks kind of okay in this. Let's watch this
kind
film.
Of okay in this.
What's your history with Labyrinth?
I feel like the first time I saw Labyrinth was probably when I was a child, but I barely remember it. So my better memory of me watching the film was probably near the end of high school. So that was a lot more interesting. That was probably when I was more familiar with David Bowie, and I was far more familiar with Jim Henson's work. I was just like, oh, look, Muppets, that's great. I was more familiar with, like, all his other films and his career. And David Bowie's pants were, I guess, something I totally noticed when I was a teenager. Holy cow! But I guess we'll get into that later.
Pants. I guess we will, yeah. Get into David Bowie's pants, indeed. All right. Well, as for myself, my history with Labyrinth is the same as my history with a lot of movies from that time. The folks would have rented it for us. They rented a lot of films like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad or Jason and the Argonauts. Lots of classic fantasy adventure movies. So that's when I saw Labyrinth. We often talked about the Bog of Eternal Stench just as a in-house thing for a long, long time, and I didn't see it for a long time until I started collecting DVDs, and when it came out on DVD, it was fucking expensive, as a lot of movies were, so I remember picking it up, like, on a sale or on the cheap one, so I was like, holy shit, I haven't seen this in a long, long time, let's pick it up and watch it, and I kind of fell in love with it all over again. So, yeah, it's a film I saw as a kid and then picked it up again later.
I want to mention, I'm really amused how we both pronounce Labyrinth differently. So it's just like the AgroCast scenario. We'll have to go back and forth on pronunciation now.
I'll probably go back and forth on pronunciation. I usually say labyrinth, though.
Labyrinth, Labyrinth.
So we're going to get right into the story of Labyrinth, because if I start talking about this or that, then we're just going to be repeating ourselves. So the movie starts. How does it get rolling? How does it get rolling?
It all begins with a teenage girl, Sarah, reading from her novel about fending off the Goblin King, but she can't seem to remember the lines, and that's probably not going to be relevant later or anything. But she's very caught up in being in her fantasy world. She's pretty much, I guess, doing live action roleplay all by herself and with her dog at the moment.
Me too.
Yeah, me too. When she gets home, her parents kind of tell her that at her age she should act more mature and maybe see boys, I guess, instead of locking herself up in her own little fantasy world.
She has to babysit her brother, and her reaction to this is really over the top. Because, especially because apparently her young baby brother, who doesn't look like he can really walk very well, has gone in to her room and picked a bear off her shelf and taken it back to his room. I think, you know what's funny is this movie is fantasy, and this is probably the most unbelievable leap of logic I have to do for the movie is how this little baby got in. And although I guess babies are tenacious, he could have got it, I suppose.
I always read that as her parents gave the bear to her little brother, and she's just accusing it on her little brother because she's so upset by him. I mean,
Oh, maybe
Sarah's
that makes
supposed to
sense.
be extremely selfish, as presented here, so.
Yeah.
Like, selfish and spoiled, pretty much.
So, what does she end up doing to Toby?
Taking lines from her novel, she recites the lines of summoning the Goblin King. And she does it all for fun, but what do you know? Goblins were waiting in her closet to snatch that baby away.
So, all of a sudden, she has a change of heart, and might this be because she's scared of the repercussions, or maybe she actually does care about her brother, but she meets the Goblin King, Jareth, who offers her like a crystal ball or something, and is it just to grant her power or
Make her wishes come true or
make
something
her
like
wishes
that.
come true? Yeah, and she decides that no, she wants Toby back, and he gives her the ultimatum that she has to solve the labyrinth in the very, very spoopy time of 13 hours, or else Toby is his forever, basically, and that kind of gets the movie rolling.
So the first person she meets up with this in this Grand Labyrinth is Hoggle, and apparently this movie thought it'd be really funny to get his name wrong like 20 times. Is this really necessary? But it's pretty much Sarah's first experience in how this fantasy world works. Like, for example, she feels that Hoggle is harassing the fairies, but the fairies are actually pricks and bite people.
Yeah. Now, this labyrinth, we're going to enter the labyrinth now after speaking to Hoggle. Hoggle shows her the way in, I think. I believe Hoggle directs her to the door to the labyrinth. Now, the labyrinth itself, do you find this as a compelling setting? Can you tell us a bit about it?
It definitely looks really worn down and old, which I really, I mean, what do you expect a labyrinth to look like, pristine or anything? But you kind of get a scale for it and spend maybe like 2 minutes of Sarah versus the drum machine trying to go through it, and all the passages look the same.
Yeah.
There was a review of Labyrinth and a lot of quotes from it like stuck with me, so I might end up repeating them.
That's all right.
But yeah, Sarah versus the drum machine.
Now, does Sarah do well navigating the labyrinth? Like, at first, how does she do?
For this section, she does a really poor job because she assumes going in a straight line might help, but it doesn't seem to turn anywhere, and when she meets up with the worm, she finally gets an idea that things are not quite like they seem, because with the power of depth perception, one wall is actually hiding behind another, and that's where she continues on. So after following the worm's advice, we have a little magic number with David Bowie, where apparently he, you know, tosses babies around and stuff about how Toby's going to become a goblin if Sarah doesn't go through with this labyrinth. Yeah. But anyway, while that fun musical number is happening, Sarah's going around trying to mark tiles, trying to navigate her way through the labyrinth. But of course, the labyrinth isn't fair. And Sarah, being Sarah, complains, "It's not fair," in her whiny tone as usual.
Yeah.
But then we get to the, I like how Labyrinth brings in these puzzles, where it's like mostly like old riddles. So we have the two doors where one is lying and the other one isn't.
Right. That's a pretty traditional puzzle.
I don't think she quite solves it. I don't know if she gets it right because of how Labyrinth works, or the fact that she ends up in the oubliettes with a really pervy hand scene in the meantime.
Yeah, that scene's pretty... it's pretty dire, I guess, because his hands are pretty touchy. Like, the puppetry of the hands is really good. It's just kind of really creepy.
But moving on from that, Sarah sees Hoggle again. Hoggle trying to trick her back to the start of the labyrinth, but Sarah's gonna use her plastic jewelry as a bribe to help her proceed. And Jareth, of course, has none of that. He catches on pretty quickly and decides to up the stakes by making the clock move faster.
He wants Hoggle to mislead Sarah as well, take her back to the beginning of the labyrinth, but Hoggle's sort of starting to like Sarah, so he kind of doesn't want to.
Yeah, Sarah briefly mentioned that Hoggle is potentially a friend, and I think this is when she mentions that she's starting to trust him, so Hoggle, never having a friend before, is warming up to her.
Yeah.
Continuing on, Sarah experiences some more weird things, like an old man with a bird that speaks Spanish on his head. I actually like this character a lot because it's really weird.
Might be the inspiration for the Minish Cap, actually.
Maybe. Actually, now that you bring that up.
This sort of starts to mark where the movie transitions from Sarah solving the labyrinth alone and getting frustrated to she's starting to make friends now. Hoggle is scared away by some howling, but that howling leads her to another friend, Ludo, who's being sort of tortured and hung upside down by goblins, I guess. And you don't know it yet, but these rocks start to go to her feet, and that's actually Ludo calling the rocks to her feet, I guess. And she scares them away, makes friends with Ludo, but she kind of gets separated from him right away, right?
Yeah, Ludo is this big, fluffy, beast-looking creature, but Ludo is a dear friend. But they can only go so far before I think Ludo falls down a hole or Sarah falls down a hole. They get separated. And I think this cues the weirdest song in the movie.
Yeah, also the worst part of the movie is the wild things. Apparently they're called Fieries. And they kind of light a fire and dance around and sing a song and kind of want to tear Sarah's head off. But I'll talk more about the song and dance number later. It's out there. It's sort of like the most out of place part of the movie, even more so than Magic Dance. But yeah, it's out there.
Well, Magic Dance had the advantage of being a David Bowie song. Chilly Dan is just, I'm not sure what's going on, but I guess we'll talk about that, because I also have a lot to say about this scene.
Yeah. So, at this point as well, Hoggle comes back and rescues her from the fireys.
Yeah, he pulls her out of the that situation. But previous to that, I think Jareth mentions that Hoggle is warming up to Sarah, and he's not too happy with that because he really wants to keep Tovey and have Sarah stuck in this labyrinth. So he brings it up that if Sarah ever kisses him, he will make Hoggle the prince of the Bog of Eternal Stench.
Yeah. So Jareth gives Hoggle a peach that will that he wants him to give to Sarah to prevent her from continuing in the labyrinth.
And Sarah does end up kissing him on the cheek, so they have that experience.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, ridiculous, but it's still not as ridiculous as the fire gang.
When Sarah kisses Hoggle, that actually sends them tumbling towards the Bog of Eternal Stench.
Yeah, Luda's been hanging around here, and they have to cross the stench, because if you touch that, you'll smell for the rest of your life, but Ludo shows off his great power of summoning rocks, and I think this is awesome, but he lets them help cross the bog. But no, Sarah has more friends upcoming.
Yeah, the Sir, not necessary, Sir Didymus the Fox, nice. I guess he's a fox, and he's riding Merlin, except it's now called Ambrosius.
I guess Sir Didymus is a little obnoxious and really into chivalry, but he's got a dog, so that's the plus.
Yeah.
I mean, there are three characters all have their weird quirks about them, which makes them an interesting cast.
Yeah.
And then there's a dog.
I don't mind him, it's just that I don't think he's actually necessary to the movie in any way, but that's just me being in our soul my old age, I guess, but yeah, no, he's all right. Yeah, at this point, I think she's hungry, and she takes the peach from Hoggle, and this is where she starts to trip balls, and she sort of has a wish fulfillment dream.
She has a wish fulfillment dream that she's in a ballroom, in a wonderful dress, people are laughing and having a great time, Jareth is dancing with her, and she seems to be really into this until she starts remembering that she should probably save her baby brother.
And she sort of has a...
She finally realizes that the stuff she owns isn't really worth it as much as, you know, getting her brother back, or realizing that there's more to it than the toys she used to have in her youth.
Right. Right. So this is a scene of growth and overcoming for Sarah. So it's a strange scene, but it's a fairly important one.
And this is when the movie starts moving out of the puzzle and meeting characters aspect too, when they reach Goblin City, which is completely action.
Yeah, I think Goblin City is sort of the weak point in the movie, but that's just me, just because it just becomes a bit of a hodgepodge of action, and it's all right. But like the big guy swinging the axe and then the big fight in Goblin City, I think it changes the tone of the movie too much. I like the mysterious labyrinth more myself. But do you feel it clashes with the movie?
I actually enjoy this part. Not as much as the beginning, likewise, but I don't know. I think maybe it does go on for a little bit long, but I still enjoy it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad. It's just I find it out of place.
Most of it, yeah. You have the giant robot, which I guess goes on for a while. Hoggle redeems himself there. And then they get chased around the entire Goblin City. Ludo uses the rocks again.
It is a marvel of set design and puppetry and all that. So, I mean, it's a marvelous scene. I can give it that. So that now they're about to go into Jarrett's citadel or castle. And Sarah, does she say that she doesn't need their help? Or doesn't it has to do with a loan or something like that? Which is like, you know, girl,
yeah,
you spent the whole movie getting friends. Like, you got to do it on your own now.
Yeah, for the finale, she says, I mean, she does appreciate her friends, but at this part, this is the part of the story where she has to go at it alone, because that's how it is.
Yeah. And now we're at the final boss. after this Escher staircase land, we encounter Jareth.
She's always trying to get to Toby, but he's always an Escher staircase away somehow. That works, yeah. But now that she's up against Jareth, Jareth once again tries to offer all her dreams. And apparently Jareth has fallen in love with her. That's something.
It was sort of in the book she was reading, though, yeah?
Yeah, that the Goblin King has fallen in love with the princess. But Sarah realizes, after all this growth, that she remembers that last line in the book she was reading, that the Goblin King has no power over her, and that breaks her out of the labyrinth. Toby is safe. She's come a long way, and the movie ends with a party.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd still be kind of nervous to have all those goblins and such in my room partying down, but at least they're not the fieries, so.
I don't know, maybe one of them was in there, but I'm trying not to pay too much attention.
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
But they would have lit their bedroom on fire, so.
Oh, no. So how do we wrap up the plot?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was sort of a slapdash, a hurry ourselves through the plot of Labyrinth, but we're going to talk a bit more about certain aspects of the movie going forward. I mean, there's two main aspects to Labyrinth. There's the Labyrinth itself, but there's also the characters. It's a very character-driven movie. So let's just take some time to talk about the characters themselves, Sarah and Jareth, and then maybe some of Sarah's various bros. But how is Sarah as a protagonist? Are her motivations, are they entirely selfish? And how does her character grow over the course of the movie?
I find Sarah almost a little unbelievable about how they made this teenager so spoiled and selfish. Like, you mentioned earlier how she wants to find Toby if she's afraid of the repercussions that she lost her baby brother, or she genuinely cares. I mean, I think deep down she does genuinely care, but there's a lot of movie to go through where she is pretty selfish. I think maybe making friends with Hoggle and the rest of the gang really start to open her up about this. I think she really comes a lot from being spoiled and realizing that all those toys she had really won't matter as much when she gets older. She grows up from the things she kept from her youth. Like, she feels like holding on to her teddy bear. She feels like that's something she can pass down to Toby now for him to appreciate. You know, all the things that she kept in her room, like the music box, the ballerina, she starts putting that away at the end of the movie. I just feel like that really shows that she's come a long way from being so whiny from the beginning.
Yeah, maybe not being as self-absorbed. I don't know how much of her tantrum at the beginning of the movie is legitimate. I mean, it seems really over the top. Her parents asked her one day of the week, basically, to watch her baby brother, and she wants to go and LARP, like you said, in the park by herself. And teenagers are very self-absorbed set, and I know there's people out there, oh, you know, when I was a teenager, I was the biggest altruist on the planet. But, I mean, teenagers are very self-absorbed because your world at that point is still very much what's around you and yourself. So, at one hand, I think her reactions, especially when how much she talks about hating her parents and her brother, I think that's really over the top, and I don't think she necessarily means all that. But there is definitely resentment there. And that's why I said when she wants to set out to get her brother, is it more of an oh shit moment, or does she actually care about him? I think she does actually care about him. But like you said, I don't think she realizes how much she cares about others until she is going through the labyrinth. So in a sense, she does grow. I think she mellows pretty quickly after the initial hate mongering, but I think she does grow throughout the movie for sure.
I mean, it's just expected of a teenager to have their wild moments, right? So, yeah, it does feel, the tantrum felt like a little over the top, but at the same time, they were really trying to show that Sarah is selfish and there's only so much movie to go through.
Right, right. Do you think she's a good character, though? I mean, I know she's, like, immediately kind of gets your, like, what are you up to kind of thing, but do you think she's a good character?
Overall, yeah, she's a good character. I feel like Labyrinth is almost too quick of a movie to really flesh her out properly, but I think from what we're shown that she develops well. It's a good coming-of-age story, and
yeah,
she's good.
Yeah. I think she's a pretty decent character as well. She's not entirely unlikable, which your first foray into Labyrinth, you're wondering, oh, is this girl, or is she going to be completely unlikable of a character? No, she's not. I think the audience enjoys seeing her grow as a character. So I do believe she's a pretty good character and a decent protagonist as well. It's like a protagonist that has a lot of growth and a lot of development that engages the audience. Like you said, there could be a lot more if the movie was a bit longer. This is 1986, though, not 2016, so the movie would have been like two or three times longer now. But I think it's all right in length. I think it's all right in length, but she would be developed more if there's a bit more time given to it. The other side of the coin, of course, is the antagonist, and that's Jareth. How is Jareth as an antagonist?
Man, knowing Jareth as David Bowie makes it so difficult to really hate this guy. Man, like, who is this really pretty Goblin King? Maybe I want to be in the Goblin royalty now, but I think as an antagonist, I think he pulls up manipulation really well, and it's too beautiful to hate. I can't talk smack about Jareth. It's so hard. But, I mean, he's a good antagonist for being cunning, and he knows how to manipulate Sarah. Does he genuinely fall in love with Sarah at the end? I actually think so. But that adds to the, I mean, it's kind of weird in a way, but I think it just adds another layer to him about how selfish he is himself.
I guess he's meant to be extremely selfish. It's not not even said why he wants Toby. He kind of wants to make him the next Goblin Prince or something like that, but he kind of wants Toby just because she wished him away, and it's something that he has that she doesn't have anymore, I think. Jareth is sort of like a comical villain when he's with all the goblins and like snapping at them or singing songs and throwing babies in the air. But he's much more dark and menacing and manipulative when he's like one-on-one with Hoggle, like, you are going to do this or this will happen to you kind of thing. So I think he plays a lot of sides well. And sometimes it's a risk to have a performer of one kind, like a musician, play a role in the movie, but I think that David Bowie is a great performer and he does well as the Goblin King, I think. Now, Sarah does meet a number of bros, friends, compatriots, traveling companions over the course of the movie. Three of them, in fact. Let's just talk about Hoggle. Hoggle's really the main one, the one that has the most character development. He's probably like the third main character of the movie, to be honest. Is Hoggle a prick? Like, he's presented as a prick. What do you think of him?
But for most of the movie, much like Sarah, who's selfish for most of the movie, he also comes a long way from his prick outset. But the movie shows that with his companionship with Sarah. I mean, he learns how to appreciate a friend, and then someone trusts him, so he gets out of that prickish closet self of him, and then he comes through and saves them all. So,
yeah,
he does a lot of stuff because he does a lot of bad things because he's under Jared's command, and obviously the Peach thing he didn't want to do. He felt immediately guilty after that.
He didn't want to do it to begin with. He was going to throw it into the bog.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hoggle, I think he, like you said, he is kind of greedy and prickish at the beginning, but I think he warms to Sarah really quickly because she gives him that plastic jewelry, and he's like, okay, now I have a friend or someone that isn't a total heel to me.
Or at least, like, not even the plastic jewelry. At least she's nice to him, which
yes,
I get the impression no one else is.
So, I mean, he's got a friend now, and I think that is, like I said, it's really big for him. And a lot of the bad or manipulative or duplicitous things he does through the movie It's more that he's afraid of what Jareth will do to him, and he doesn't want to do this stuff to Sarah or her friends. So it's his arc is sort of about overcoming his fear to do the right thing, kind of thing. So in that sense, I think Hoggle's a good character. So not even a frustrating character, because you know what his motivations are, so you don't really get frustrated with him like you do some other characters that make decisions that seem out there. Hoggle's pretty much wears his heart on his sleeve, and you kind of know his motivations, and you kind of feel for him that he's being manipulated and threatened into doing these things. So I like Hoggle as a character.
Yeah, I like him too. He comes around.
Ludo is there to be the muscle, and also he's friends to Rocks. You have anything you want to say about Ludo?
I would give Ludo a big hug. I mean, Ludo doesn't have a character arc, he just, you know, growls and stuff, but Ludo's great, because he seems like a real friend right from the start.
Yeah. Ludo's sort of the typical don't judge a book by its cover, or, you know, not all things are what they seem kind of thing, because he's a big monster, but he wants to be friends with everyone, so he's there for that purpose, and I don't mind him. He's not in the way. He's a good character. And like you said, he's lovable, so it's all good.
That's the important part.
I don't think Sir Didymus, and this is my own opinion, I don't think he adds a lot to the movie. Like I said, I don't mind him, and he's got a sheepdog, so that's cool.
Yeah.
But I don't think he adds a whole lot. They meet him in the Bog of Eternal Ascension, and then the Goblin City is basically right after, so he doesn't even get much of a chance to develop his character. And I don't know, what do you think of Sir Didymus?
I don't dislike him, but I really agree that I don't really get his purpose in the movie. It's just, he's there to help out during the Goblin City fight, that's nice, but
yeah.
He doesn't really have an arc, and again, he's not there for a long enough time like Ludo, where you get some aspect that not all things are what they seem, but I don't know what Sir Didymus thing is. He just has a sheepdog. That's pretty cool.
I think he's there for a comedic aspect. Like he's a little swordsman, and his dog runs away and hides on him and all that. So I think that's part of why he's there. Again, you were saying that you feel the movie should be a bit longer for characters to be more fleshed out. I think with another half hour on the movie, I think Sir Didymus could have been more legitimized as a character.
Yeah, have something going for him. I'm not sure what, but something.
Again, I don't feel he's bad, but I don't think the movie would have suffered if it was just Ludo and Hoggle.
Yeah. Should we have a sheepdog, at least?
Well, you know what? She does have a sheepdog IRL in the movie, so, you know, they could have taken Merlin with them.
Yeah. Merlin could have had an own arc or something, but yeah, I mean, again, he's funny, and he's alright, just kind of there.
Are there any other characters you think are worth talking about? Do you, like, in general, how do you feel about the characters, like the sort of flavor characters in the Labyrinth itself, and like the worm and the old man and the goblins and all this?
I actually really like the supporting cast a lot too. Like, yeah. All the puzzle characters are really interesting, such as the doors or the door knockers that they have their own ridiculous jokes. I also really like the statues and the Ubiat, who just really want to do their job and say,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Go back. Like, they just add a lot of flavor and characterization and life to the Labyrinth, even though it looks rotten and worn down.
Yeah, it makes it feel alive.
Yeah.
At this point, we're going to talk about some of the technical aspects of Labyrinth and how various effects and aspects work in terms of a movie. I think it's interesting. One of the documentaries or commentaries I've watched about Labyrinth talks about how back then in film you said never work with puppets or animals or kids, and they did all three in Labyrinth. Do you feel that Merlin's, the sheepdog's reactions are realistic? Do you feel that Toby's, the baby's, reactions are realistic? Do you feel that it's an effective use of babies and animals in a movie?
I guess Merlin's a little out there, I guess. That one was kind of pushing it. But Toby, as an actual baby, sure. Toby just seems to be having a fun time with the goblins, having no idea what's happening to him.
So yeah, Merlin, part of his scenes are actually Muppeteered as well. Like, obviously, it's not a real sheepdog all the time.
Yeah, most of the Sordidimus stuff is when Merlinus is a puppet. Not Merlinus, sorry.
So
Merlinus.
yeah, I don't want to break the illusion or shatter your worldview, but it's not always a sheepdog. I think they do Toby a bit better than the sheepdog, but sheepdogs are notoriously cranky, so they're lucky to get what they did out of Merlin, I suppose. But he's a good dog. He's cute. He's nice.
I also don't want to
I'll
break
give
the
him a hug.
illusion that during Magic Dance that was totally a fake baby that Jareth is tossing around. So,
Whoa,
if anyone
whoa,
was
whoa,
concerned.
what? What? That baby wasn't real?
I know, how shocking, right?
I want to get right into the songs then, because the songs are memorable, I guess, but they actually fit in the context of the movie, or they kind of break immersion. I feel that if you have David Bowie in the movie and there's no songs, maybe you're missing out. But yeah, do you feel that they kind of break the immersion of the viewer?
With the exception of one song, which we'll get to very shortly, I actually do like all the songs in this movie, and I do feel like they fit very well with what's going on. Like, the beginning of the movie has Underground. It talks a lot about how, like, one of the lyrics is like, "No one can blame me for walking away." Like, it just comes back to, like, Sarah feeling about running away from her childhood. Well, not running away from her childhood, running away from responsibilities. And then there's also Magic Dance, I guess, is a little out there, but I guess it was meant to be a fun song.
But the Underground song, that's not actually performed. That's part of the score.
Yeah, that's part of the score.
Magic Dance is performed. It's a song and dance number.
I guess it just wants to show puppetry and what happens in the Goblin Kingdom. I
Yeah,
guess it is a little out there, but it's a fun song, so I can't hate it.
I guess it does have flavor and it gives you some suggestion as to what Jareth wants to do with Toby. He's like thrown really high, I guess, is what he wants to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's David Bowie, and it's a strong performance, and I actually like the song, so I'm not too mindful of that. But you
Hey,
were
Matt.
suggesting something else?
Hey, Matt, you remind me of the babe.
No, we're not getting into a song and dance number on the podcast. I'm sorry, but yeah, you were saying there's another song that really does not fit with the movie. That's really out of place with the movie.
Yeah, so the third, I guess, main song in the movie. Well, I guess it would be a second song because Underground is the score, but Chilly Down with the Fire Gang. What is this song? It's just really out of place in a movie where things are supposed to be out of place.
I can see the purpose of the song is that these fireys, I guess they're called, are completely unhinged and dangerous and unpredictable. But the song is really out of place, and the green screening is really fucking terrible. Like, and it's not even that great a song, so it's really out of place. And I don't think the movie would suffer for not having it, I think.
Like, even if it had good green screen, it's the song is just not that good either. It's just, I'll always remember when they have to sing a line really fast, and I'm just like, come on, what is this? And what are they even singing about? Like, if you hang out with the fire gang, you don't need to worry about anything. I'm just like, what is this even? I think we're past the point where Sarah has moved on, that she has tons of things to worry about, so I don't know. It's not gonna
I
convince her
mean,
anymore.
I guess it's sort of disturbing when they talk about how she can take her head off and then she slowly pulls their heads off and throws them away in a on a bad green screen background. It's just a bad part of the movie. I think the next song there's one during the ballroom scene
Yes, as the world falls down, yeah.
that's very ethereal and it really fits the mood. And I believe there's also one that Jareth sings when she's chasing him through the staircases.
Yeah. I never remember the name of the song, but that song also fits, even though it's a little
Oh, it
out
fits.
there,
It
yeah.
fits because of the tone he sings it
Yeah,
in. It's
yeah.
really good. So, yeah, I mean, I think Magic Dance, some people can take it or leave it. I think it actually fits with the movie. I think it's fun. Chilly Down, no. No, I mean, I don't know. It's just so out of place. It's like,
I guess it could have been a quick scene, but it's not. I've tried so hard to at least like the song or at least like the scene, and neither's happened.
I think if it was more about dialogue and like they want to help or asking, how can we help you and all that, and it slowly you start to realize that they want to kill her. I mean, that's like, that would be all right because you're demonstrating denizens of the labyrinth, but this song is just, and the effects are just bad.
Put a puzzle behind this? I have no idea. Like something.
Yeah.
Oh well, oh well.
The real puzzle is why is it in the movie? I mean, the Muppeteering and all that's good, it's just the green screen's bad.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we're talking about the green screen. That's an exception, but because I believe that the set design for Labyrinth holds up pretty well. But how do you feel about it?
I think the set design is really good. It really feels like they're not actually on a set. They actually filmed, they actually built walls of Labyrinth and started throwing their actors in there, but I think they actually did a really good set of creating the environment and all the like citizens of the Gollum City and things in the labyrinth. I think they did a really good job making all these motions, and the puppeteering is great.
Yeah, we'll talk about the puppeteering in just a moment. The set, I agree, like the labyrinth is mossed over and looks old, and even the tiles that turn around after being marked, that's well done. I think that Chilly Down really is the exception of having a bad set and a bad green screen and all that. Sure.
I think compared to the Labyrinth, Goblin City feels a bit more like a set, but at the same time I think they did a really good job having all those goblins running around and just having places for all the actors to stay, and I think they also made a good convincing city there too.
Yeah, it looks like a city. It looks like a city.
And obviously there's some painted backdrops, but
for
the most part, it's still good.
The goblins all have personality as well, and like there's stuff thrown around, so it looks like the city has personality, I guess is how you'd say it. The city has personality. It's sort of a hovel goblin city, it looks like a city that these goblins would live in, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So even though I don't find it as visually interesting as the labyrinth, it's still pretty damn good. We're talking a little bit about the effects and about the Muppeteering itself. How are these in general, and how do they compare to like their contemporaries, and do they hold up today? So, for instance, how does it compare to maybe like Dark Crystal or something like that from the same era? And how does it compare to like CG blockbusters of today? If someone that grew up today were to watch Labyrinth, how do you think they feel about the effects and the Muppeteering and all that?
I think the Muppeteering and the effects look really good for this age. There's very few times that I would be like, yeah, it's obviously a puppet. I mean, there's obviously the sheepdog that really cries out, but like definitely the main cast, like Hoggle, Ludo, which is probably an actor in a suit, and then Sir Didymus, like they all feel like actual characters. They're not really puppets. They pull those off really well. I think for the Dark Crystal, which I've seen once and I barely remember it, I think they went over the top of puppetry, like, really well done, so we can't compare to that. But for Labyrinth, it's really good.
Yeah, I think it looks as good or better than a lot of its contemporaries. I think it's a common argument today, practical versus digital effects, and where obviously most of Labyrinth is practical effects, I think it holds up. Because, like, the suit for Hoggle and the suit for Ludo and the suits for the goblins, and just the general craftsmanship of the Muppets themselves and the suits themselves and all that, and the set design, I think it holds up because a lot of it's practical, and there's a lot of argument about that today, but in my opinion, practical effects are often more convincing because they're actually there with the actors, and when it's from a genius like Jim Henson, I think that easily holds up today.
Yeah, I agree. There's some parts where I think CG would have helped, like maybe a bit more background stuff going on during the Goblin City, because I know there's a lot going on, so maybe
some Jawas and Dubaks?
Yeah, maybe. But not something of next like Star Wars. I'm just saying like a little bit of CG.
Yeah.
That would be okay. But for the most part, yeah, the puppeteering is good. We just don't, and I don't know if you want to put some CG on the fire. You know, it's like, let's get past the Chilly Town.
How about we use the CG to cut the fire game?
Oh, man. Sorry to everyone who actually likes the scene, but I just couldn't get it.
Is there people that like the scene?
I have no idea.
Write us in and tell us. So this is just getting back to that final point. If someone grew up with movies today, how do you think they would feel about Labyrinth?
I would hope they enjoy it a lot, because I think it just looks really convincing. It feels like an actual set, and it feels like a good pull from, like, a fantasy. So it feels like you actually went into, like, an actual forest and filmed this. It just looks really good, in my opinion.
Yeah, it looks good. Maybe it doesn't have the over-the-top action that people like these days, but I think it's a story that is timeless, and I think the effects hold up. Sort of getting into the final moments of our podcast here, the final thoughts. However, you wanted to talk a little bit about the implied lore in Labyrinth?
Yeah, I always found, like, the background history of Labyrinth really interesting. Like I mentioned before, the novel that Sarah is reading obviously plays into what she will experience. I guess it also pulls into, like, that she actually experienced this as a dream. If you pay attention to the stuff in her room, there's a lot of things in that room that show up in the labyrinth. I think there actually is a fiery gang, like, plushie somewhere in a room. There's also the musical box, which alludes to the ballroom scene.
Yeah.
And I think it's implied that her mother went off to, like, the reason why she's with a stepmother or a caretaker is because her mom ran off with an actor, and I think that actor is David Bowie. Well, not literally David Bowie, but it's an actor played by David Bowie, as you see in a photo album.
When does this come up? I mean, I must have missed that.
It's really discreet, but I think she's looking through the photos, or at least there's a photo on her mirror, and there's a picture of her mother. I think this is somewhere in, like, background notes or something, because I really read into the labyrinth.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't picked up on this, but if that's true, that's interesting and might explain some of her resentment towards the woman that's in her life now.
Right.
Is Sir Didymus Lancelot?
Maybe. I don't know, it would have been a bear, though. Maybe Lancelot is Ludo.
Could be.
Yeah. But, yeah, there's just a lot of interesting things that I find fascinating. Just like when Sarah first introduced herself to Hoggle, he mentions, of course, your name is Sarah, and something to that line. So it just kind of all plays together, which I think is a really interesting aspect of the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely implied that the book is... Well, it's not implied, it's... basically overtly tells you that the book is responsible for what transpires in the labyrinth. But
I think the book is even called Labyrinth.
Oh, it is. It is. It's called Labyrinth. It's sort of like, do you like the Neverending Story? Have you seen that? Or
yeah, I've only seen that once, though, so that's a movie I can't really talk about.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very similar in that respect. If that's because of the book, then it's very similar to Neverending Story. So, within the labyrinth itself... like, a lot of it's very classic puzzles or very classic riddles. And I guess you could say that a lot of that's inspired maybe by what she's read before or, again, directly in the book. Like, when she does the truth or lie thing, she says, look, I could never figure it out before.
Yeah, these are all probably experiences, encounter, like, riddles she's read.
Yeah.
Just to add to the whole, you know, puzzles in the labyrinth thing.
So, do you think it was all a dream? Do you think that Ash Ketchum is in a coma? Or that Squall is in a coma?
Oh, God. I don't really like it was all just a dream. I mean, it kind of implies that in a way, but... the movie blends itself weirdly at the end that... I want to say it kind of actually happened. Like, she was actually transported in a way. It's just weird. And the ending just kind of... gets really weird when you see Hoggle in the mirror, and I thought that was fine, but then it turns to a party at the end. That's when the party happens. That's when I get really confused on what actually happened.
Maybe it's tough for me to say if it's a dream or not, because everything seems to be all right at the end, and then again, like you said, all of a sudden there's this party. Does that imply something about Sarah? Does that imply something about the Labyrinth? Does that imply something about Jareth? I don't know if there's any notes or interviews as to what the ending actually means, but
yeah, I wouldn't be sure on that either.
Yeah. No, it's interesting that there is a lot of implied lore behind everything, and obviously when you're constructing a set as intricate as Labyrinth or a story as intricate as Labyrinth, you kind of say, okay, this has to have a purpose, because if it doesn't, then why is it there? Like, if you're going to make something feel stories, it has to have a story kind of thing. So there's actually some lore invested into it, so I think that's pretty cool.
Because after all, the Goblin King has to fall in love with the princess, as the story tells.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, that's awfully sudden. So, I mean, does that just happen because it happens in the book, or is it because of how tenacious Sarah is? Does that somehow turn Jareth's head? I don't know. It's kind of out of place, but it kind of isn't.
I mean, he does claim that he takes Tove because that's what she wanted. So is it a reason that he wants to make her happy so Sarah can live with him?
So we've kind of gone through Labyrinth pretty quickly, but I think we've covered a lot of this. And really, folks, you should watch the movie for yourself. I mean, it's probably too late to say that now, listen to the podcast, but let's give our final thoughts about Labyrinth. So what kind of final thoughts do you have about this?
I guess if it wasn't obvious by now, I really love Labyrinth. Enough that I saw it on the big screen because I was far too young to see it when it first came out in theaters. So the moment I found out it was playing in a theater at midnight, I just canceled all plans. I'm going to go see this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really great to see, you know, David Bowie, rest in peace, on the big screen and all that. And it's such like a cult classic, I guess, if it's considered a cult classic, or at least a classic anyway.
But I remember it's probably too big for cult status, but it's definitely a classic.
Yeah. I remember going to that movie theater at the midnight showing, and everyone there was obviously a huge fan of Labyrinth. Someone actually dressed up as Jareth, so it was nice when everyone was just singing under their breaths, like they didn't want to be obnoxious about it, like singing all the songs and laughing at all the jokes that we all know are coming. It's a really nice movie, and glad it stuck around for such a long time.
Man, imagine how awkward it would be if everyone clapped and cheered after the Chili Down.
That didn't happen. I think we're all kind of... It was pretty silent during Chili Down, if I recall correctly.
No, I mean, I guess for my final thoughts about Labyrinth, you know, it holds the test of time. I like it. I don't like it maybe as much as you do. I think I like some of the other Henson adventures better. I like Dark Crystal more, I think. And I know that's probably heresy for me to say that, and I know you obviously like Labyrinth a lot more, but
I didn't say the Dark Crystal was a bad movie.
Well, I don't know. It was pretty close to being a bad movie.
I said it was all right. It had really good commentary. This isn't the Dark Crystal cast, though.
Yeah, exactly. But I kind of like other Henson movies a bit more, but Labyrinth... in saying that, I'm going to start waffling back and forth, obviously.
Okay, yeah, we can't talk about the Muppet movies, because I'm going to talk about the Muppet Christmas Carol, my favorite Christmas movie ever. But that's also derailing the subject.
Yeah, so, I mean, Labyrinth, it's a classic fantasy adventure movie. It's kind of dark, so if you have a kid, watch it with them, kind of thing. Don't make the mistake people did at Easter and put Watership Down on for their kids and walk away, but, you know, I think it's a good movie to watch for your kids. It's a heartfelt movie. It has good morals. A spoiled teenager becomes much more accepting of her brother at the end. So, yeah, it's a classic movie that's worth watching, and I still really enjoy it. And, I mean, what more can I say? We've said a lot, so I'll leave it at that, I think. All right, folks. Well, thank you for listening again this month. If you want to reach me, it's Matazoic on Twitter, MATTOZOYC. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. Website's the same, matazoic.com. Chris, where can we reach you?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CAWRASU.
And how about the Aerocast, Air Horse?
If you'd like to reach our dear horse fighting against the Quaker Oats Man, it's twitter.com/Agrocast, AGROCAST.
What can we expect in a month's time?
Next month is my birthday, so I hope everyone's excited for that. But for my birthday cast, we're going to be playing a game that I really love. It has a very suspicious-looking moon in it. It's got some weird atmosphere. It's got a character I really like that begins with the letter S. It's got a clock tower. It's Castlevania Aria of Sorrow.
Yeah, so begins with the letter J. I know who that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to playing this now that you mentioned it because, yeah, I like Aria of Sorrow quite a lot, and I've got to see if I dial back and not get every soul, because that's a time sink, but we'll...
You gotta get that Chaos Ring.
Yeah.
I just suddenly have the kick again for hanging out with Soma Cruz and going through Aria of Sorrow again. I'm just gonna play Castlevania. So, it's my birthday. That's my birthday request, Matt.
Yeah, so that'll be a good cast. That'll be a good cast. Lots of Castlevania love on the podcast. So hopefully it looks delicious.
Sorry. Okay.
Thanks again, folks. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
All right. Cheers. Thank you.